Hello, this is Chris O'Regan, and you're listening to The Sausage Factory. Welcome to the 202nd episode of The Sausage Factory. In this show, we interview video game developers and ask them how they made their start making games, what their influences are, and who inspires them. Split into two halves, so we should focus on themselves, and a second half will discuss the game they're here to promote, which in this case is The Maestros by Assistance Games. Andrew, who are you, or what do you do?
Yeah, I'm Andrew Arridge, and I am the game lead on the Maestros. I guess it's typically a game director is the name of it. So I designed a lot of the original systems, and my background is programming and games programming.
Cool. Okay. So, second, you did the first question well. Excellent. you recognized that you knew what your name was and what you did for a living. So the second question... this one, it gets a bit tricky now, and it gets worse. Like I said, how did you start making flashy, lighty video games?
Yeah, I think I started making video games probably in high school as soon as I learned enough programming to make games. And I made lots of terrible, terrible games in high school that were templated off of Flash games that were mostly just very, very difficult and not particularly well designed or anything like that. And then I actually ended up going to, I'm of that age where I could go to university for game development.
Yeah.
And so I went to the University of Southern California and through their games program, in Los Angeles, which was the engineering focused side, but it crosses over a lot. And so I took a lot of time, designing games as well, and even making art for games and things of that nature. And through that process, made a couple of games myself for Android and Flash games and things like that. And so that was where I really got into the swing of things, I think.
Okay. So what were you making your games on? Was it just on like a library platform, like a Game Maker or Flash, or I'm just trying to...
Yeah.
It's just like various things. You weren't sort of getting low level, beyond that.
Yeah, it was kind of a mishmash. You know, part of it was our program tended to teach us Unity, I guess, to an extent. So I made some things on Unity, but I had a lot easier time with Flash when I was new, making 2D stuff. This was like prior to Unity having 2D support and things of that nature. And then when we got into bigger games and larger groups, as we, you know, progressed through our years in university, we started using Unreal Engine, which was Unreal Engine 3 at the time, which was ultimately what we used to make the Maestros.
Okay. And definitely, as demonstrated, we're going to talk about the art style of Maestros later, because that needs to be discussed in a good way. Please don't think. It's just like, it really, yeah, that needs to be talked about. But before we do, we always rush ahead on this show.
Sure.
It's extraordinary that you actually, you know, went through a university course, obviously graduated. Did you think you got much from it, ultimately?
Yeah, and I feel very privileged to say that, because most of the people around me that were paying tens of or hundreds of thousands of dollars to go to school were not getting something out of it. The program was pretty awesome in that it was very focused on applying knowledge and building games. Ultimately, I'd say we built, you know, 6 to 12 games over the 4 years of varying size, like everything from, you know, something that you could probably put together in a week or two to things that took, you know, 9 months or more to build. And having that variety of experiences was really useful. And on top of that, now being out here in the industry for, you know, 5 years or so, all those people that I went to school with are now working at Treyarch and Blizzard and Rockstar and what have you. And so I feel like I'm pretty connected throughout the industry, which has helped me in a number of ways, not the least of which is just like having somebody to, you know, pitch and moan to.
Yes, yes. And that having that reservoir of people, pool of people that you can reach out to and say, I remember you did in the dorm, remember? So you owe me one. Anyway, I'm kidding.
A little bit of blackmail now and then.
Fine. But it's wonderful to hear that these courses are working. You know, that's important because they are very young, aren't they, compared to the other, should we say, more traditional subjects one reads. You know, and it's nice to know, it's great to hear that they're actually maturing and they're actually producing, they're doing what they're supposed to do. It must have been very, very hard in the early days to make these. Indeed, to actually pitch them, to say, look, we're gonna make a course about making video games. Why? You know, that's that would be the overwhelming question for most, you know, university institutions. Why? It's like, you know, doing a degree to make a toy. No! And until you realize that we're not going to go down the road, everyone, of video games are art. That's a debate. It's not even a debate anymore. It's just stupid. You know, but it was a thing 10 years ago, but now it's just
absolutely
dumb. You know, and I'm just, it's also a thing I try to explain to people from, I'm relatively old. I'm part of Generation X, so forgive. Mm. And our generation, we don't really appreciate the fact that games to younger generations like Y and Z, etc., they're just a thing. It's not really that important. It's just another means of entertainment. It's just a thing.
Right.
For the most part, there are exceptions, I grant you. Of course, there are exceptions in all things. But generally, that's what I've observed. It's just another thing. It's not really that, you know.
I think it's interesting, even, you know, since I'm pretty young, but even since I was a kid, like how pervasive games are, and they're not stigmatized in the same way about, oh, you know, you're a nerd or only boys play games or whatever. Like all of that stuff is just kind of out the window now because everyone just grew up with it, just like we all grew up with movies, you know?
Yeah, it's dissipating. I'm saying it's gone away. Let's not go ahead of ourselves, but it's lessened significantly. I went to an expo recently, a retro gaming expo with all those arcade machines, which I know you guys actually get a lot of kick out of, like seeing these older games made not with, you know, Unity and stuff. They didn't have that. It just had ones and zeros. They didn't have any of the, they just had assembly. That's all they could do for making games, which is, you probably think is horrifying, but that's all, that's all they could do to make games. But they did. They managed to pull it off. And the reason I mentioned this show, this the expo I went to, is that it was filled with the broad spectrum of people who attended it. It was incredible. You know, it was everything from young, old, men and women, girls and boys, that kind of thing. It didn't matter. No one really. I only figured it out after I left the show. I went, wait, you know, because I was sitting there waiting to play an arcade game, and in front of me was two teenage girls and like having a great time playing this arcade game, this old game that's probably three times as old as they were. You know, and then it's like, oh yeah, I never really. Huh. It's, like I say, it's just a game. It's just a film. It's just a book. It's just a play. It's the same thing over and over again. So, on a related note, because I'm good at that, stringing things together, segues, segues they call them, but I can't say that because I've actually identified it. That means it's no longer a segue. So, what are your biggest influences as creators of things? What do you think Systance Games locks onto more than anything else as its inspiration or driver?
Yeah, I think this kind of goes back to my history in games, just playing games. Mm. And the first thing that really hooked me, and it was pretty awful, honestly, was StarCraft 64 on the N64, which is the worst abomination of a real-time strategy game.
I forgot they made that, because I know they made Command & Conquer on the N64, which is probably very bad. You know, because Command & Conquer really belongs on the PC. You can't. It does work on the PlayStation with the mouse. Mm. But, yeah, it really is very much a PC game. So, yeah, so you went from that, would you say, is it really that bad?
I think it was pretty bad. I think there was a lot in that era, not even just in RTS games, of figuring out what optimal controls are. They hadn't even, I mean, you think about, you know, GoldenEye and games like that. They hadn't even figured out what the best way to do first-person shooter controls were in that era, and certainly not putting something like, you know, fast controls on large number of independent units and stuff like that. I don't think that was really well targeted on console until I think it was Halo Wars that was like, we're going to tackle this problem, you know, of what is the optimal way to design a game around, excuse me, an RTS game around the controller versus, you know, kind of porting it and smashing it onto the controller.
Mm. Yeah, it was an extraordinary controller. No one knew how to hold it, no matter how many times... You'd explain it to people. They'd pick it up, they'd put it in one hand, and then they'll, like, you know, put their hand over the, put their fingers and thumbs over the joystick. Like, what are you doing? it's not that hard. It really isn't. But it was, apparently. Yeah, I recently bought a controller on Kickstarter, which actually reconfigured the N64, cause I still have one. Mm. With into a regular sort of like dual pad stick, but it hasn't got duals, we've only got one. And then the other one's just a D-pad.
Right.
Perfectly fine. You know, the ergonomics, they just basically said, let's just take this nightmare and turn it into something we actually use these days. Okay. And it's just, you know, it's the evolution of controllers is a, you know, subject of theses, you know.
Yes.
And as you well know. And, you know, I've got one. I've got an Xbox One controller here hooked up to my PC because I dumped my 360 one because I got annoyed at the D-pad. I just lost patience with it. Like, I don't have to put it up with this anymore. So I just replaced it with an Xbox One controller. But, you know, it's got a myriad of buttons. And you put that in the hand of a novice and it's just horrifying. And, you know, what did they try to do 10 years ago? They tried to get rid of the controller. We all know what happened there.
Not fully successful.
So, going back to your original question then, so you were inspired by games, both good and bad, but at least they're pioneering, yes?
Yeah, no, I started on the N64 and I eventually went on to PC and played StarCraft and spent more of my life playing StarCraft than I spent sleeping for many, many years when I was growing up. And then eventually, you know, that turned into Warcraft 3, which was a huge, huge inspiration for the Maestros and everything that I've done, honestly. I thought that was a really fantastic and innovative game, the way they added in heroes to the genre and the neutral monsters to the genre in a really, like, meaningful way. And it created a really dynamic, like, everyone's always moving around the map in Warcraft 3, and that creates opportunities for, oh, this guy ganks you while you're trying to kill this creep, and that's a really bad position, and how do you get out of it? Do you have to use a town portal or things like that to teleport back to your base? Like, lots of trade-offs.
Yeah, it's
that came out of movement, I think.
Yeah, constant fluidity. I forget that aspect about Warcraft 3, because it's been a very, very, very long time since I played it. I did actually finish it. It's one of the few RTSs are finished, because I never finished Command & Conquer. I just got annoyed with particular levels and, like, why can't you just let me build stuff? No, you've got to escort these 7 units across the map. That's ludicrous! what are you going to do? This is not an action-adventure. Just let me build stuff and then blow things up with them. No. Damn it! So
did you play StarCraft II Heart of the Swarm?
No.
They were pretty notorious about using that level style. to their credit, they did a much better job than a lot of previous titles had. But yeah, it was certainly like, am I still playing an RTS?
Yeah, what is this? Is this a weird sort of third-person Diablo clone thing? What is it? And Dawn of War is a favorite of mine as well. I'm not sure what your feelings of Dawn of War, if indeed is an RTS.
Yeah, one or two.
One.
Or three.
One.
Because they're basically three separate takes on the entire genre.
They are completely three separate takes. And because you've got stupid space marine and lots of yelling for the Emperor, how could you possibly go wrong?
I love Dawn of War 1 as well. I thought that was a fantastic game.
It's a wonderful game. And three... they tried to go back, but it's not quite.
Yeah.
It's not, you know what I mean? It's not quite there. Anyway, so that's a wonderful thing to be drawn to, is to to take an inspiration from a pioneer of video games, and they continue to be pioneers.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they take a game idea and go, "This is interesting. It's not quite there yet, is it? Well, no, let's have another go. There.
Let's do this for another 5 years and see if something comes out."
Yeah, let's get to work on it for 5-10 years and something may or may not come out of it. It's quite likely that something will, but there's still a significant chance that there won't. I mean, look at Overwatch. That was based on an MMO that never came to be. So,
yeah,
quite incredible. So, I might know the answer to this next question based on what we just spoke about, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What developer do you most admire in the industry and why?
Yeah, I mean, it's a trap question because Blizzard does so many things well and because they're so tied to, my childhood, right? I think their focus on design and their focus on quality and design is something definitely that everyone in the industry kind of looks up to. And I really think I've had a fantastic example set by like their ideas around polish and how they're going to focus on design and what they're willing to prototype and throw out and all of those things. I think that's really admirable.
Yeah, it was a bit of a trap question, but it's not, I didn't think it was going to go that way. And but it's not, it's a common answer. It is a common answer. They're up there with the likes of Nintendo, are they not?
Absolutely.
You know, they created an extraordinary work ethic and a design ethic, maybe I should say, that says that we are willing to spend an enormous amount of time to make something just right. And even if after many years it doesn't turn out, then we won't release it. Most developers, in fact, 99.9% of developers and publishers don't have the time or the resources to do such a thing. You know, to turn around and go, "I just spent 7 years on this, but it's not very good, is it?" No. Okay, then we'll release it anyway. That's what normally happens. That's what normally happens. No one sets out to make a bad game, everyone. So it's an old adage, and it's true, because that's why they're old. You know, it's true, because it stood the test of time. It's a fact that no one likes to, like, no one sets out to make a bad game.
I'll give a slightly more interesting answer about something that I've been really impressed by recently, which is as an RTS player who believed deeply for 10 plus years now that somebody someday would make a good RTS on mobile. The new Command & Conquer Rivals game on mobile is impressively designed, just bafflingly good that it actually functions on a phone, and like the design works. It's actually single screen. It plays out on a hex grid in real time. Like all of these things that don't make sense, and clearly they had to try a lot of things to know that. No, actually, it's a fantastic idea, and more so, they're operating within the constraints of this like really heavily monetized, like we have to have pay to win in every mobile game, and blah 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 blah. And they're trying to create fairness around this. And so I've been playing the beta for this for 2 or 3 months now. And the way that they're implementing systems to create fairness when they have actual pay for power systems is like very, it's an impressive design dance, whether or not, you know, at the end of the day, that comes out to be a horrific, like the pay to win just overwhelms the game. Like, I think they're doing a really fantastic job of like playing within the constraints.
That's an impressive thing to produce, to actually create a what is ostensibly a game that demands a lot of real estate on your screen, so big that it can't actually take up all your screen unless you zoom out and you can't really see anything anyway. You know, it even has a mini map to it. For it to say, for them to say, "You know what, this doesn't work on a phone." Of course it doesn't. So let's try something else. Because when you see people try to do like virtual joysticks and like, "What are you doing?" Just what are you doing? We're just trying to put it. No. I mean, sometimes it works. That's not fair. Sometimes it works. But, you know, one of my favorite games on the phone is Alto's Adventure and Alto's Odyssey, which has recently come out. And that's an infinite runner where you just basically tap the screen. But it just still requires skill because you've got to tap it just the right point. Otherwise, little dude crashes. And you feel sad and you start again. But, you know, it's beautifully designed and wonderfully developed because it's minimal sort of input. You just got to sit there and the only skill you have is hitting that thumb. You know, just like Oli Oli. It's another game, although not on mobile. It did start life on mobile, but the fact that you've got to hit a button before you land the skateboard is genius. Like, oh, yeah, that requires skill. So, yeah, it's all these little things, all these design developments have happened over the last 10, 15 years, and people now understand that game design is a thing, whereas years ago that wasn't regarded as a skill or a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you can certainly do a degree in, because why? There's not a thing. You know, it's people who make games who are programmers who will just fall into it, or, you know, they don't. People don't set out to be game makers. They just fall into it as a career, typically. Right. They usually go off and do some day job for 20, 30 years and realize that, oh, maybe I can make games because I really like playing them. That's quite common. Still happens to this day, of course. But
especially in design, because what is the correct background for game design? Like, nobody can answer me that question. You know, I've worked with people who are like, yeah, I mean, I studied philosophy, and then I don't know. And then I've worked with people who are like, yeah, I mean, I came out of computer science, I programmed games, and then I designed games. And like, none of them really, there's no pattern matching to be done there. It's just you kind of take on a philosophy, and you're kind of a student of the medium, you know.
Exactly. And it's, you can have a very diverse group of people, and you can, which is becoming ever more prominent in the game industry. Again, it's an old adage I have, is we need more people who have no interest in Star Wars making video games. And it's basically saying that whatever gender you are, or whatever creed or what have you, or color of skin, that matters to it about anything. That doesn't matter. It's really what you're interested in is what I want to know about. And it's really what you can bring to the medium. That's what I want to know about. So that's what created games like Gone Home and Papers, Please, etc., Stanley Parable, which is a great parody show experience. So, like, you're going to go left. Oh, no, he goes right. Oh, he's one of those, is he? You know, it's
just, I love Stanley.
Yeah, it's just wonderful that it ribs the player relentlessly when they don't do as they're told. But it's a great sort of parody on things. And only game, or people who make games who don't have a lot of interest in making yet another Space Marine game is maintains its survivability. Maintains its relevance, encourages others to come and play.
I have honestly spent a lot more time recently playing through visual novels and all, you know, Telltale stuff, and I'm forgetting the studio, but Heavy Rain and a subsequent title or two. Like, those are just so different from your normal gaming experience, and it's really refreshing that that's kind of been what I've been craving recently, more than another Space Marine game.
No, there's anything wrong with yet another Space Marine game. You Halo fans, you don't worry, everything's okay. So my last question of the first half, see, look, you made it, well done.
We did it
Almost. You got to ask the last one though. Now, because this is a podcast about video games, we are legally obliged to ask this question of our guests, which is, what are you playing right now?
Oh, yeah. So right now, I guess my top ones are Rainbow Six Siege is fantastic, I think. Having, like, grown up and played some Counter-Strike, but never really being a tactical shooter guy, Rainbow Six kind of pushed me over the edge, where they're like, no, we're just going to dump strategy and depth on you. You thought Counter-Strike was hard, just you wait. This is a character tactical shooter with varying lines of sight and varying ability to, you know, penetrate walls. And, oh, by the way, we each have special abilities, most of which hard counter one or the other. Like, I think that's been really, really interesting. And God bless the people who have to level design on that game. It's like three levels in one. The other one is that Command & Conquer Rivals game that I was talking to you about. I've probably played 1,000 matches of that in the 3 months or so that I've had access to it. and I've really been enjoying that and trying to get as many other people as I can to play it, because I think it's being written off right now because EA and pay for power and all these things that, you know, the audience is upset about. But I think the design fundamentals are fantastic. It's a lot of fun. And then I've been playing through Final Fantasy 14 a little bit, mostly to get the MMO itch. I never really got it out during the time where it was very, very popular with WoW and things like that. So I'm kind of trying to circle back around and maybe get to some endgame content and see what it's like to go through larger dungeons and that kind of experience. And that's more of a like student of the medium thing than purely like, I'm going to go play this game that I heard about, you know?
Yeah, a lot of the listeners now might be wincing at this point where Chris is about to delve into his long and lasting experience with World of Warcraft. Don't worry, everyone. I'm going to hold it back. I won't do that to you again. I'm not going to do it. But I'm going to say that, yes, you can learn a lot from dungeon crawling, whether it's on a video game, an MMO, like a multiplayer dungeon crawl. That shared experience is creates some interesting dynamics and play dynamics that it's almost like a dance. No, it is very much like a dance that you have to create, and that's quite a thing to design. Also to make it entertaining and challenging at the same time. And
right.
That's quite difficult. It's quite, because you're dealing with humans, and you know they're very unpredictable creatures. So it's no, that's laudable to actually delve into that objectively to see what you can learn from that. And speaking as someone who plays both pen and paper RPGs and you know video game RPGs, there are stark differences and also similarities between the two platforms, if you call them platforms, probably not, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, what do you think the similarities are? I'm curious.
Well, what I find is it's not the role playing, definitely not, because the pen and paper role playing is very, very free form, and very strange things can happen. Because as a DM / GM, depending on what game I'm playing, when I'm sitting behind a screen and I say the words, what would you like to do? And then the player says something really weird, I have to go, okay, we do that then. But with a video game, that doesn't happen, because you can't do weird things typically because you're much more constrained.
Yeah.
The similarities are combat. There's turn-based combat in both systems, but the difference, you know, so you have that very sort of odd system where you go, you hit, okay, oh, now it's its turn, it hits, and it's bizarre, and it's apparently happening all at the same time over a period of 6 seconds. It's weird. And that all happens. The difference again, though, when it slips in with the role-playing games, pen and paper role-playing games, is the things that the players are doing. It's normally quite weird. You know, like I bop him on the head with the butt of my rifle. Why? Oh, it's fine. Do I have to kill him? No, you don't. Well, we'll just knock him out. Oh, God. Right, ask any DM what the worst thing is about role-playing games, and the retort is players. It just messes your plans up just royally. That's fine. Because that's what it's about. So, that's an excellent response to that last question. Thank you very much. And I think I spared the audience my diatribe. Well, not diatribe. My lecture on the merits of World of Warcraft. So, thank you for that. I'm proud of myself. I reined myself in. But that's in the first half. Thank you very much for that. Well done.
Yeah.
Give you a round of applause for yourself. But now let's delve into the second half of the show, where we do indeed delve deep, that's the word, delve again, into the Maestros. So, first question. Regular listeners will know it isn't a question. It's a request. Please tell us, what is Maestros?
Yeah, so the Maestros kind of... It started as, I want to make an RTS that is more streamlined and more approachable for people who love games but maybe are inundated by these systems. And what it ended up being was sort of this hybrid between a MOBA and an RTS, which I like to think of kind of as a spectrum. And Maestros lands somewhere in between the two of just like, I control one unit or I control many units or I fight monsters around the map or I fight for expansions and bases and things like that. So yeah, I think it's most appropriately a hybrid RTS MOBA. It is primarily multiplayer, made around 3v3, and you control a commander and you're going around the map fighting these neutral creeps like Warcraft 3. But when you fight them, that is how you build up your army, and you build up these sort of basic units that are kind of malleable and you can later transform into more interesting and powerful units, and each of those have a special ability. And then the win condition is kind of deathmatch. You kill the other team's commanders and you win the round and rinse repeat.
Right. That's quite concise, and it sounds like you've said that a few times before. I have another take on some of the aspects of it, and I'm just going to talk about
it
because there's mechanics, and I've been playing games for very long time, and which is good and bad when it comes to the Maestros, because unfortunately, and I try to not have them, but I've got these bags with me, and they're full of things, of preconceived ideas, which you'd much rather I'd set fire to them, that's fine, but unfortunately I can't, because in order to gain comfort and understanding and for me to continue playing games, I need to have an anchor of some kind, otherwise, you know, I kind of lose it. So what struck me as very unusual about the Maestros, the first thing that really... when I was playing through the tutorial, which I dutifully did, I'm not one of those people go, oh, I had to play this. No. I'm a big believer in reading manuals and instructions, because you get way, way more out of games when you do that. I found this out not relatively recently. Maybe relatively recently. I don't know. But anyway, point is, read instructions. Read this. When an error comes up on the screen, read it. Seriously. Just read all of it. And if you don't understand it, just read it one more time. And then you'll understand why the error is coming up. Don't just see the blue screen of death and think, oh, I'll just go into blind panic. Not that anyone gets blue screens of death anymore, but you know what I mean. It's just read the screen. Some developer sat there and made the error message for you. Just for you. So I'm going to ask this question. I'm going to pitch it in a way that some listeners might not understand. I'll explain what I mean by this. When I say this question, I know you'll understand, but I might have to frame it out a little bit. Why are the player's creepers generated by killing neutrals? So everyone understands what I'm... I know you understand that, Andrew, but I need to... Basically, in the Maestros, you have... you get off as commander on your own, pretty much. Sometimes not. Depends on the map. I don't know. And then you, in order to generate small creatures that you do actually control, you can actually put a big box around and have them do things and stuff. In order to get more allies to your smaller, weaker creatures, initially anyway, to your cause, you need to kill what they call other creatures in the map, which aren't necessarily involved with the bloodshed that you're involved with, but they're just sort of kind of innocent bystanders. And you, in order to get more sort of units, so-called, in MOBA terms, creepers, you need to kill them. So I just want to ask, how did you come up with this?
So there's probably two frames for it. There's a narrative frame and there's a design mechanics frame, and I'll start with the design mechanics. I told you we wanted to make an RTS that was streamlined, and in my head, a lot of the problems with RTSs for new players, and this is coming from someone who deeply loves all the stupidly complicated RTS systems, was just that there's all of these systems, and some of them have very incremental value to the end gameplay of like tossing two armies at each other. and the interesting like strategic maneuvers that happened prior to that. I was trying to distill some of the concepts that make RTSs down, and resources and like minerals and gas or whatever you know, gold, whatever it is, are kind of a means to an end the way I see it. And the means to the end is there are things that I can do outside of direct conflict with the other player that improve my chances to win a battle with that player. And so if I could do that in a way that involved fewer systems, I was going to. And originally, we had a resource gathering system, and we were trying to make this hypermobile RTS that had some of those elements of Warcraft 3, where someone comes up on you while you're fighting a camp, and you and that creates a weird situation. Eventually, we figured out the system where you fight these monsters, and you're going to generate units from that because you already know how to right click on another unit and use your abilities and perhaps dodge some skill shot things from the taller little neutral guys. So if we reuse that, which I think is arguably more interesting than having a bunch of workers going back and forth between a gold line, then maybe that would be a more interesting play. So I think that's the mechanics side of it. I'll do the narrative side as well because it's brief.
No, it's good. Yeah,
we have no narrative reason. we started out without that mechanic, but we wanted to get to that more distilled thing, and so we kind of shoehorned the narrative around it, which is these neutrals were always a source of the resource on these maps, which is Arcanium, and Arcanium is the core resource used for the robots that the one faction uses, and for the mutations that the other faction uses. But ultimately, you know, games have a lot of things that they do or don't explain, and I just thought that this was a more interesting mechanic, and if it happened to be one of those things that was not particularly well explained, maybe the players would forgive us, because I think it's fun.
Sticking with the creepers, then. It's my second question there. Having these units, I'm going to call them creepers anymore, because it's a very MOBA phrase. Having these additional units you have on top of your commander, there you go, it's better. There are pads littered across the map that allows players to change those multiple multiple collections of these beings and put them onto a pad, and then they change into something else. I want to ask, how did this come about, and how do you prevent people from becoming overwhelmed with options?
I think that the Maestros itself is intended to kind of pare down a lot of the options. For a given faction, you've got 5 unit upgrade choices, and you've got the 1 basic unit, and then you've got your commander that you can select before the game. And I would say that decision being removed from like the high pressure situation of the game is kind of a moot point once you get in the game. So because they are littered around the map, you don't actually have a decision on whether or not you get 1 of 5. It's kind of about where you're at and maybe the route that you took while you were fighting the creeps or something like that. It came about because our lead designer, he was an amateur Halo player in the professional scene. And he had this sort of frame of reference that basically we can achieve some of our goals by drawing on the FPS genre, which has a lot of movement, and they have very like designer crafted placement of weapons or power ups or things like that. And if we used that like designer crafting to place units around the map, we could create points of contention. We could create this idea that the route that you take around the map matters, like it does in an FPS, like it does in a MOBA. So if you really, for your composition, want the Skybreaker unit that can, you know, do the near global like drop on another point on the map, sort of Dawn of War style, then you're going to have to go into this southeast corner, and that's a high conflict area. So maybe you need to commit 2 people to that corner. And our designers then can say, but there's less creeps that you can farm in that area. So you have more powerful units, but you have less resources to gain them. And now we've got an interesting decision that you have to make as a team and as a player.
I see. So it's a bit like having the armor power up in Quake 2. I'm that old. And going, well, I know where that is on that map, so that I'll sort of circle around to get that eventually, hopefully, on the premise that I can actually get there and not die. But yep. No one else has got there first. Oh, wait, they have. Never mind. That's normally happened with me anyway. I see. There are layers to the Maestros, everyone. There are layers. And I wanted to talk about this because these units they're very interesting, all of them. They do. One of them is the conductors, I think. They have they create laser beams of death when you spread them out properly. You can create traps quite elegantly with those, can't you? You can go charging off into the map and go, just stay there, and you go charging off, and then someone goes running after you, and you go charging back, and then you just throw them into the death trap. Does that happen?
Oh, yeah. I do that all the time. Conductors are a lot of fun. The electric beams between them, there's a lot of uses for them, and it's kind of a high-risk, high-reward, high-skill unit, perhaps sometimes too much. I think that this is an area I'd really love to work on while we're in early access. It's like, what is this unit? How useful is this unit to a new player versus an experienced player? And I think that it maybe is not useful enough to a new player and too useful to an experienced player because of the amount of damage output you can have if you get 10 of them and use them to their maximum potential.
Yeah, you create a grillage of death, as I call it, and you end up laying them out very quickly. Because you've got to do it really quickly. You've got to do it, you know, that's what I do is I pull myself out, I press a bunch of buttons. And there's loads of shortcut buttons in this game, which is perfect. You just, and the two types and the icons would be fantastic, saying, you know, hit Q for this, hit T for this, and it's great. And you whack them up and you just sort of spread them out. And then you go charging after someone who knows is nearby. They go chasing after you. They just, and before they know it, like, they see it. They see it. They know what's going to happen. Like, where's all your Oh, wait.
I think it actually gets to something pretty core to the game, too, which is, and I hadn't heard this phrase. Somebody used this phrase describing the game, but it's exactly what we intended. It's a high lethality RTS. And that's a phrase that's usually talked about in FPS games, which is to say, like, oh, we can kill you with a bullet or two, or we can get you a headshot and you're done immediately. And that happens a lot in those tactical FPS games and things like that. But no, this is an intentionally high lethality RTS game. It is very much about the positioning and the choices you made before you go into battle, because the battle will be short in some cases. And so it's a lot about your preparation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, when they first play this, when I was a friend of mine sort of saw me sort of playing it and goes, where's the towers? What? Where's the towers? What was? Wait, the layout map's weird. Like, please go away. You know, just trying to explain to them that it's not what they think it is. You know, we don't need another one of those. Maybe we do. I don't know. I'm not going to challenge. Although the ones that have been made since League of Legends and Dota haven't fared too well. Let's face it. They're the two kingpins and anything else. Yes, you've got Heroes of the Storm. Sorry, I should have mentioned that too. But I think it's basically those three and everything else has really done terribly well. Well, then again, Smite. Oh, shut up. Right, we could go on. So, the point is, it's a very different experience. You're not about taking out towers, and the team play is a very different dynamic. It's not like in MOBAs where you are not the center of attention. You are not. The center of attention is actually the map itself. You're just a part in it, and you are one of those members of those five people who are trying to take over the map and destroy the other side. That's all you are. Whereas in this, that you can have the lone person a little bit causing chaos, whereas the other two are actually got a 2x2 formation where they're actually bouncing off each other, sharing resources with each other, and actually creating another more formidable force. Do you know what I mean? So you can split or you can have three loners, or you can have it's very similar to FPSs in that regard, because you can have different dynamics of play that all work to a greater or lesser degree.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong observation. Like, team play is extremely important, but you're forced away from each other if you want to maximize resources,
yep.
and you're forced together if you want to win combat. And so you're going to be making decisions about that, and there are going to be trade-offs with any decision you make there. I always really loved playing 3v3 in RTS games, and you always had that slingshot position. Whoever was more central, you could funnel them resources, you could let them tech, etc. And you could choose to create that sort of situation in the Maestros where you have someone on either end, kind of on the front line, and somebody in the back just cleaning up, getting a full army and transforming, and then coming in and choosing to win one side or the other. But you can also have everyone off on their own or have everyone together, and there's trade-offs for that.
And that's the making those split-second decisions is, they can be a make or break a game, I found. It's quite obvious that when I was training or practicing, that playing against the bots is interesting, but they would do some very strange things, because that's what bots do. But at least they're sort of teaching you the ropes and saying, you know, you can't, your MOBAs, you're meant to stick together. Typically, you got teams. There'll be one player who has to go off and do stuff, jungle run, stuff like that. That's fine. But normally it's 2x2 formation all the time, right? Otherwise, you're in trouble. You'll be in trouble. When you're caught on your own, it's very, very bad. Because in this game, might not be. Because if you're actually creating a trap, as I am, and it's not me a one-on-one battle, the idea is you need to take someone out. There's no tower to take out. You're taking out the heroes. And again, sorry to compare MOBAs again, but taking out a hero would do something, but only slightly disrupt the flow of play. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not your goal. It's just, you know, a thing you can do to disrupt the other side. But that's all it is. Whereas in the Maestros, no. That's a point.
Right.
You know, that's a big deal. That's a point. So, anyway, let's go on to the art style now, because we did hint about it earlier, and even I may have answered this question already, but I want you to delve deep into it further for me. The art style is quite unique, and it has like a cel-shaded element to it. I'm happy to say I'm running on my my 1060 sort of GTX or NVIDIA card, which I don't know how I got that before the mining started, but I did. So it runs very, very well on that card, I have to say, as you'd expect. And that's not me boasting. I just wanted to share that with you because it does look an extraordinary game, and it deserves that kind of, you know, lush sort of power behind it to get it going. Although it's not a particularly taxing game as far as I can see. You may disagree, or I don't know, you can fill that in. But tell us about the graphics style, please, and how it came about.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So we started with something pretty different. We knew we wanted to have these two factions. We wanted them to be very asymmetric in their gameplay, because I believe very deeply in asymmetric factions in RTSs. I think it creates really interesting stuff. And so they're very asymmetric in their design as well. And so we wrote this very like traditional, you know, medieval European faction. And but they're also, you know, robots, and it's very dieselpunk inspired. And then on the flip side, we have these like very like aloof, very like animal, like integrated with these animals, creatures, and mutated people on the Alchemists of Regalis. And so the styles are kind of springing up out of that, but we started with this crazy out there idea, and we were going to make the game look like a Van Gogh painting. I have to like send you an image or something. It's just so different. We're going to make the game look like a Van Gogh painting, and it had all these brush strokes in the textures in 3D, had these brush strokes in it, and it looked fantastic. It was beautiful if you took a still shot, but when you start moving things around, like what's the famous painting with the sky that's kind of moving. Once you start moving things around, you've got this art style that's basically built to portray movement in a static 2D image.
Yeah.
And then you actually move things around and your mind is just baffled.
Brush strokes don't make any sense anymore, basically.
Right.
It's all like disjointed and like, well, someone's just taken a painting and tried to animate it by cutting bits out of it.
And it looked very cool, and I think it's something that I would have been willing to go with. But when you get into a more competitive, like, multiplayer environment, if your art style is conflicting with the core goals of, like, I need to make split-second decisions and I need to be able to read the game really quickly, and going back to, like, Blizzard's decision-making and stuff, if you watch the evolution of StarCraft II's art from their early alphas and betas to the ship product, it was all about readability for the players.
Yeah.
So we moved away from that, and we said, like, what if we make it look like Warcraft 3? That reads really well. We get to kind of use simpler textures, and hopefully we can produce things a little bit more quickly, but we still do them hand-painted and in that style. And then the more recent evolution from that is we ran some beta or playtest or something, and people were giving us a lot of feedback on the clarity of the game and things blending together. And we were, like, very much towards the end of the cycle, and we're like, okay, I talked to our artist and I said, let's try some things. Let's try some low cost, you know, high risk, high value things and see if they start to work out. And literally the first thing he tried was, you'll notice the sort of inking, the, like, Borderlands-y black outlines or dark outlines around characters and elements in the world. And all of a sudden, everything that moved and mattered stood off the screen so much. And it just instantly improved the readability, and it brought moving characters off the environment. And I thought that was a really valuable change we made. Honestly, in the 11th hour, that was just a few months ago that we did that.
Well, because it works. It's been proven to show that when you have the 2D sort of, like, almost very flat textures behind it, and then you place a very animated 3D model on top of that, it says, it pops out of the screen almost and says, "I'm a thing that matters."
Yeah, and those outlines really say, like, no, yeah. this is where it yeah. comes off the environment or whatever, because if you have a blue unit walking next to the water, can you really see it very well or whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Whereas if you've got a nice little black outline, it's all there is a thing. And it used to be a thing, you know, cell shading used to be a thing 15 years ago, but it kind of went away, just like Bloom went away. That was a good thing.
Yes.
No one wants that back. No, developers, stop it. No. No one wants to go back to that. We all know Prince of Persia was as great a game as that was. Too much Bloom. And that was the thing. We look at Oblivion. And I was watching a video about it, like a retrospective look on Oblivion, which is lovely. I mean, he said, you come out and what's the first thing that strikes you? Is it the sky? Is it the clouds? Is it the grass? No, it's the Bloom. Is there a way to turn it off? Probably. But
funny little anecdote. When we started working on Maestros, it's in Unreal 3, right? So, you know, the engine's built around Unreal Tournament 3 more or less, and obviously it's very flexible, but so by default it had things like a little bit of Bloom and motion blur, most importantly. And so when the camera moved, it would do motion blur. And so you have this RTS game panning with motion blur, it was potentially the most vomit-inducing thing I've ever seen in a video game.
Second only to VR,
like, where's
right?
Yeah. Where's the off button on the motion blur? Obviously, we turned that off immediately, but...
Wow, that's funny. That's funny. But yeah, like I said, motion blur in some games, and yeah, it's you don't want that. It's like second only to VR. So as regards to how to vomit while playing video games. Final question. I know all good things must come to an end. But this is a question that is asked of any game that has asymmetry attached to it, which you admitted you like to pursue. That's great. That's a laudable thing to go for. However, I must ask this question. How did you deal with balancing with each character? Because each character does have a unique set of skills and abilities. And how are you making time to balance the game? I know you're on early access, so that's an obvious answer, but what have you done up until now?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to shout from the rooftops that we have this beautifully balanced game, like we're a chessboard or something like that right now. There's a lot of work to do there, but we pursue asymmetry and balance across asymmetric factions. First off, because I think it creates something much more interesting, even if it isn't perfect. it's kind of an artistry, and that leaves a lot of room for us to say it is balanced that you can fly halfway across the map with this unit and crash down wherever you want and do tons of damage because – and this, I guess this kind of gets back to the philosophy, which is balance within and of itself. It's balanced because, oh, well, it takes a long time to do that, and we're telegraphing where that's going to happen. And so you're able to avoid it if you want to, and if you can't avoid it, it's because I've put you in a really good situation and I've used the map well, or my allies well. So there's a lot of, like, is this individual unit balanced? And I think that comes down to it. There's definitely some math behind things to say that, okay, we want to stay within this range of health and attack, and we'll maybe allocate some points to one or the other. But that did break down the more and more we added abilities to the game and passive abilities to the game, and they're just not perfectly comparable. So, for instance, the aimbot, the tank looking thing, it has a penetrating shot. It's like, well, is a penetrating shot that can deal damage to these four units balanced against this other unit, which has this charge up shot, which does more damage after 3 seconds? And the answer is, you play the game a lot. You maybe look at, you know, how good players are performing with particular units against other units, and you just play the game a heck of a lot and look at the data, the outcome data, not just the input of how much health does it have, how much whatever, but it's like, can a really effective player outperform over and over and over again with this unit? And so far, I don't think there are too many situations of that, especially within our first faction. The second faction, there's lots of work to do there, but
okay. Well, that's the struggle you can have in a character-based combat game.
Yeah,
that's what I've described it. Maestros is a combat game. Leave it at that. What? Yes, it is. It's a third-person combat game. That's rubbish. No, that's all I've got. I'm not gonna, because if I apply any other labels to it, you get preconceived ideas that aren't true.
It's true.
So it's just,
it's true.
don't bother. And I think that's going to be your biggest challenge for you. You know that.
Oh yeah.
You've got the base. The game itself, the Maestros, is there. It's pouring that content in and making sure that content doesn't break it or undermine it. And yeah, I can only wish you the best of luck in that endeavor. So, Andrew, it's been fantastic having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
You've been a great guest. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did.
Yeah, me too.
And so the Maestros is out now in early access, or is it imminent? It might be out by the time this show comes out. But it's on Windows PC at the present, yes?
Yep.
Any plans for any platforms, or are we just sticking to Windows?
We'll stick to Windows for now, especially while we're in early access.
Yeah. My laptop's a Mac, you see. That's why I asked that question.
Sorry, friend.
That's all right. No, my gaming PC, as I described to you earlier, certainly isn't. It can play all of the things and then some. So I'm happy about that. But again, Andrew, thank you very much. And we wish you the very best of luck with the Maestros.
Have a good one.